bringing us to Rav Ordman, one has to appreciate the greatness of Rav Ordman, in that very often we've been privileged to have speakers that have spoke to us in the community. But it's rare that you can have a person that can explain the foundations and fundamentals of Judaism, and at the same time be a great Torah scholar in many, many areas, even though we often hear Rabbi Ordman limited to a certain area, but he's a person that we have to really appreciate his true learning, sits and learns and lives in the city second to Yerushalayim, the city of Bnei Brak, really a Ir Ve'im B'Yisrael, a beautiful city of Torah among the Jewish people. One has to appreciate that we have the honor of schlepping Rav Ordman all the way from Eretz Yisrael to speak for us this evening.
You can stay standing to the next time.
It's not young people.
I don't know where Rabbi Van, whenever I hear these introductions, I don't know whether I told a story that I heard from, was the chief rabbi of the British Commonwealth, Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Jacobovitz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. He once told a story about the American tourist who was visiting Israel. Yeah. But I understand that Americans don't visit Israel, they're doing Israel. That's the way they say it in American English, correct? They're doing Israel. Anyway, he arrives in a place called Meir Shearim, ultra-Orthodox Jerusalem, and he sees a child over there with bald head, long sideburns, a typical Haredi child, and he said, I've got to take a picture of this kid home. So he zooms his camera on his child, and his child looks at him aghast. Aghast. So he says, smile, shmeichel, techayech. Okay? See, he doesn't understand why he's not doing it. He says, why don't you smile? And he says to him, so the child asks him, where's your yarmulke? Where's your headgear? So he doesn't know what to answer. So he says, the heavens is my headgear. The haskan. And the little child looks down, and he says in Yiddish, Azar gruise hitl for azar kleine kettle, such a big hat for such a small head. That by fact, you've given me a big hat for a small head. That's what I want to say. Beautiful. What I want to talk to you about this evening, it's really basic, something to understand, and maybe even to talk about at the Leil HaSeder when we'll be at the Seder together with our children. And that is, we have to understand, I mentioned this yesterday in another talk, that the Torah is not a history book. Maaseh Avot Siman Lebanim, everything that happened to our forefathers is a sign to us of what it's all about. And there is and Hashem told Abraham, I want you to remember that Yodoa Teda Kigir Yez Al Acha De Eretz Lo Lahem, your children will be in a strange country, Va'avodu V'inotam, they'll be enslaved and they will suffer. And after that they will go out with great wealth. And the truth of the matter is the wealth, the Medrash says, the wealth that Hashem says he will give them is not wealth, cash, but he'll stand at Mount Sinai. That's where you'll get the wealth, to hear the truth, the emes. And we understand from this that Mitzrayim, something had to happen in Egypt that would prepare them for that wonderful day of receiving the Torah. What is it that will prepare them for it? One word. Slavery. Avdut. The question is why? Why is one going to be a preparation for the other? And this is what I'd like to explain this evening. A lot of people ask the question about the relevance of religion. That's why I call this talk Egypt, Pesach, when they ask this question, and often if I'm talking about religion, not talking about other religions, I'm talking about, when I say the word religion, I mean the Torah way of life. What do they mean when they ask that question? They're asking the question, can religion enhance my life? Can Torah enhance my life? Now, if that is the question, the answer is a categorical no. The question that one has to ask is not whether religion can enhance my life. The question is not whether religion is the relevance of religion to my life. The question has to be asked is, can I be relevant to Torah? How do I make myself relevant to Torah? Not Torah relevant to me, but me relevant to the Torah. And I want to explain what I mean by it. When a person says, can it enhance my life? It means, I have my values, I have my goals in my life. Right. And now I want to see whether Torah can help me to get there. If that's the case, then Torah can't. A person, in order for Torah to change a person's life, he has to make himself relevant to them, to the Torah. The person says, I have my values. I have my ideas of what is ethical, what is moral, my ideas. When a person says that, Torah cannot help him to clarify it. The moment he will find himself involved where he has to give up of himself, he'll be out. Let me explain this. I want you to imagine I have one of my PowerPoint presentations on a completely different lecture, right? Let's have a look at ourselves as human beings. Forget about the fact we are Jews. We are one of 7 billion human beings on planet Earth. What concept would you say is the central focal point? One word, the central focal point in a person's life that makes his life meaningful. Around that one word, everything in his life is centered.
What's that word?
Hmm?
The self.
The self. I am the most important concept in my life. That self wants to achieve certain things in this world, such as family, career, he wants to health, he wants to enjoy himself, he wants to have money, he wants to have all these wonderful things. In one word, we call it happiness. A person wants to be happy. Those are his goals for him in his life. The self is the central focal point of his life. Everything that a person does is something which produces what Dr. Viktor Frankl calls, in a lecture I heard from him in Australia, he calls it self-evaluation. The fulfillment of the self. Self-fulfillment, call it whatever, self-fulfillment, self-evaluation, whatever. Fine, that's fine. In other words, the music I listen to is the music which talks to this self. Not necessarily to that self. I might enjoy Beethoven. Somebody else enjoys Michael Jackson. Okay? It depends. The clothing I wear, the woman I married, the books I read, the career that I have are things which make me, this self, feel good. In fact, let me tell you what happens over here is this. This has produced a major problem in the Jewish people. When the self is there in the middle. Professor Bernard Reisman of Harvard University wrote a book called The Jewish Genealogical Book. I met him in Sydney, Australia when I was there. And he writes in his introduction that there is a Jewish identity crisis. We have an identity crisis. We have Reformed Jews, Conservative Jews, Ethnic Jews, Cultural Jews, Nationalistic Jews, you name it, Jews. Okay? We have every time. Where does it stem from? It doesn't stem from an interpretation of what is Judaism. It is, in fact, an adoption. People adopt those aspects of Judaism which makes them feel good as Jews. And no Reformed Jew is going to tell me that there are aspects of Reformed Judaism which he doesn't like. Because if he didn't like it, he wouldn't be a Reformed Jew. You have every type. You have ethnic Jews. They feel Jewish, proud to be Jewish. And what do? They've adopted certain aspects to the self to make them feel good as Jews. Usually, it's interesting, he says, that all these aspects and customs that they feel close are all linked to food. That's why they call it gastronomical Judaism. Yeah. He eats matzahs on Pesach, gefilte fish on Friday night, right? Cheesecake on Shavuos, hamantaschen on Purim, and donuts on Hanukkah. So in other words, you adopt those aspects of Judaism which make you feel good, the self feel good. Fine, that's one type. Then you've got, I met a person who is, you wouldn't believe this story, you just wouldn't believe it. There's a Judaism called cultural Judaism.
What is that?
What is cultural? People who enjoy, who there's certain culture, they like the culture, the Jewish culture, whatever it means, I have no idea. Anyway, all I do know that in his autobiography, Shimon Peres, the president of Israel, writes in his autobiography, and I've always understood he was an intelligent person, he says he sees a revival of Jewish culture in the world. Now hold on to your seats. When here's a person, an intelligent person, makes a statement. And do you know where he says this? Fiddler on the Roof has even been translated to Japanese. That's a revival of Jewish culture. So now you have da-da-da-da-bum-bum in Japanese too. It's unbelievable.
That's what he means.
What, that's what he means.
Yeah.
What's it got to do with Judaism? Fiddler on the Roof. I'm toppled in Japanese. Now, I'll tell you, I met a person like this, an intelligent person. It was a story that happened in Australia. I was giving a home session. I gave a home session about an issue I can't remember what I spoke about. All I do remember is what happened at this home session. And that was at the end of my talk, a certain gentleman stood up to ask me a question. And till this day, I remember the question because he never gave me a chance to give him an answer. No, it's not a joke, because when he finished the question, he sat down, had a massive cardiac arrest, and died on the spot.
Oh, oh.
Which obviously put an end to the evening. It doesn't matter. But all I know is that since then, while I was in Australia, they decided at every lecture where Rabbi Ortman speaks, there should be a doctor in the audience.
We have one. We have one.
That one, it never happened again, never will happen again.
What was the question?
Wouldn't want to, it doesn't matter what the question was. You want to know what the question was?
Yeah.
The question was this. If God would appear to us today in our day and age, like he appeared at Mount Sinai, would we accept the Torah today as we accepted it then? That was the question.
That's a good one.
So good one. Okay. They didn't give me a chance to give him an answer. I didn't know who this person was, but I don't know why. I felt a moral duty that I should be present at his funeral the next day. At the Melbourne Hebrew Congregation Cemetery, there I was. There were 40, 50 people there. When they closed the grave, a gentleman stood up there to eulogize him. Eulogizing. He is professor of history at Monash University in Melbourne. In other words, an intelligent person. And I'm going to tell you what he said about the person who passed away. Verbatim, literally, word for word. He said, Yankele, you were the true Jew. You had the true identity of what it means to be a Jew. You weren't an Orthodox Jew. You had enough questions of where was God during the Holocaust. You weren't a nationalistic Jew. You know what's a nationalistic Jew? A Zionist. You know, you sit in a home in Denver, Colorado, in a home so large you have to say Tfilat HaDerech from the entry to the kitchen. And the guy is Zionist. Why? Because some 6,000 miles away, there's a little country in the Middle East, yeah, called Israel. I asked him, tell me, do you fast on Yom Kippur? He said, no, I don't fast on Yom Kippur. Why? I don't feel that the person has to be, to feel Jewish, you have to fast on Yom Kippur, or something like that. He says he wasn't a Zionist. He wasn't an Orthodox Jew. So I was thinking, what's left? What are you going to tell me? Et latkes on or donuts on Hanukkah? Listen to this. He said, Yankele spoke Yiddish. That made him the true Jew. Mm-hmm. Professor of history at Monash University, an intelligent person. These are the cultural Jews of the Yiddishistim, the Jewish theater, the Jewish comedians. Yeah? Mm-hmm. They almost don't exist anymore. He spoke Yiddish. So in other words, what has happened over here is this. That people take the self, you adopt those aspects of Judaism which makes you feel good about it, and that's the way you identify yourself as being a Jew. This is the problem. And you have today, so I ask the question of all these reform, conservative, ethnic, cultural, nationalistic, you name it, right? At least is there one common denominator that if you believe in God at least? And the answer is?
Yes.
Not necessarily.
No.
If you like God like latkes, you put him part of the equation. You don't like him for whatever reason. He's out of the equation. And here in this wonderful country of yours, you have a movement called the Movement for, listen to this, it's like the Aseret B'nai Haman in one breath, right? It is the Movement for
Atheistic Judaism.
You can be a Jew and an atheist. If it suits the self. This is what here's the problem, where the self is the central focal point of your life, then the self decides not only the goals in his life, family, the car, and everything that goes on which makes you feel good. I like just to tell the story, I don't know if anybody, I live in Israel. I can't believe that there is you have publicity stunts on Israeli radio, and they have, for the last few months, they've been having a publicity campaign for an American car, to sell an American car, called the Buick LaCrosse. You know about this car?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? The Buick LaCrosse. And they tell you about the cross, about the engine, and how wonderful it is. You know, in a few seconds you have to speak. And at the end of it, when they've told you all about it, it's worthwhile buying this car, yeah? Publicity stunt, then you get an American voice coming out on that thing in English. He says it in English, in American English. He says these words, Buick LaCrosse, made to inspire. Mm. Do you hear that? Mm-hmm. Does it sound reasonable? Do you know what that message is? Mm. They're telling you, you are a nobody. You have no self-esteem. But if you buy one of our cars, you will feel you're a somebody. Mm. It's unbelievable. Made to inspire. Anyway, this is what happens. But what now happens is the next part. Where the self is the central focal point of a person's life. Now the question over here is this. Every person feels, I'm not an animal, I'm a human being. A human being has to be ethical, a human being has to be moral, and a human has to be decent, upright. Okay. Now the question a person has to ask himself is this. What does it mean to be moral? What is ethical? What is moral? You know what the answer is? The self decides. I decide. So in fact there is no ethics. There are no ethics. There is no morality. Everybody decides for himself what is right and what is wrong. This is the tragedy. You could argue, you can't tell me one single moral issue of which there is an agreement among men on earth that that this is wrong or it's right, there will always be an argument. Why? Because a person feels. If I feel ethical, I want to feel the way I feel it, not the way the other guy feels it. I want to feel good with it. I'll give you a couple of examples, one of them is horrendous even, but I think we have to know this, and when you're talking to people, other people, to open our eyes and realize what we're looking for, what tone is going to tell us. I'll give you an example. This is a personal story that happened to me in a certain country in the world. I was lecturing in that country, and I was asked to give a talk in a secular Jewish school to the teachers during their break. I came early, and I asked the principal of the school if you can allow me to, I'd like to go to one of the classrooms. I'd like to see a classroom. So he took me to a classroom, a 14, 15-year-old, over there. He opened the door, we walked in, and as we walked in, this is the scenario. A teacher was standing, a boy was standing, and with an accusing finger to that boy, he said these words, "David, I received a phone call last night from a parent who saw you going home on the bus. You were sitting, the bus was full, people were standing. An old man of 85 about was standing right next to you, and you didn't stand up to let him sit down. David, I don't want to hear a story like this again. Sit!" I thought, Baruch Hashem, at least there are some educators in this world. At the end of this talk, that teacher came up to me and asked me questions about what I'd spoken about, and we had a discussion, a dialogue between us, and he makes a revelation to me that he didn't agree with what I had said because he's an atheist. He doesn't believe in God, he doesn't believe in anything spiritual. Okay. So I thought for a second, he doesn't believe in it. Well, interesting. His name is Yossi, that's the teacher's name. And I said, "Yossi, I want to ask you a question. Do you remember what I saw in the classroom this morning? He said, "Yes." "Look, my name is also David. Do you mind if I stand in that 14-year-old boy's shoes for a few moments?" He says, "Why?" I said, "Tell you why. Sir, teacher, I don't agree with you. I don't believe that a 14-year-old boy should stand up for an 85-year-old man. Why? I'll tell you why. I'm the future of human society. I have another 90 years to take a lot of mileage out of these 2 feet. And there are no spare parts. So I feel that for the good of the future of human society, I should sit for 10 minutes. This 85-year-old man walking around like this, his career's finished. He's finished his career on planet Earth. Every day that he continues to live is just at the expense of the taxpayer. So I feel I should sit. He should stand." So Yossi says to me, "Exactly, this is our, don't you feel you should have some respect for a human being?" I said, "Teacher, respect is something emotional. I'm talking to you something logical. But I'm okay, I would respect him, but I don't know who the guy is. I don't know who the person is. Maybe the guy was sat in prison for 30 years as a serial rapist, right? Would you respect such a piece of garbage? No. So I want him to write me out his life story of 85 years. And then I'll read it and decide whether to stand up for him." So he says to me, I told him, "By the time I get to the age of 5, I'm already getting off the bus, so you can sit down anyway." So he says to me, "If this David," he talks to me still as a 14-year-old boy, and he says, "David, if this is what you believe, if this is what you think, then you're a fascist." "I'm a fascist." I said, "Because you're a capitalist. I'm not allowed to be a fascist. Who says you're right? Maybe I'm right." So Yossi says to me, "Rabbi," I've grown now, I've become rabbi, okay? He says, "Rabbi, what are you telling me that stand up? I said, of course. But there's one difference between you and me. What is the source? I asked you as an atheist. What is the source of your information that you can coerce your personal opinion on another person, on another child? He says, there is what you call universal values. I said, maybe 100 years ago, not today. Today, you ask any, ask yourselves, ask your parents, when they were your age, were the values then the same as of today? And what will be the answer?
No,
things have changed. Things change all the time. There are no universal values. Nothing. So tell me, what right do you have to say to him that you have the right to tell him that I don't hear a story like this again? You see, there are no. You can argue any value you like. My answer to him was, I do have a right. Because this is not my values. These are God-given values. He tells me how to live. Not I'm telling the child how I feel you should be living. And my value is that at Sinai, God said these words, Mipnei seva takum vahadalta pnei zakeh. Stand up for the aged, have respect for the elderly. Period in your language. Okay? That's it. I can't argue with God and say, but I'm the future of human society and I've got another 90 years of my life. He knows all that. You stand up. I want to tell you something. It's unreal. Sir Martin Gilbert, British historian, wrote a book called Diary of Nuremberg. He investigated the Nuremberg trials. Mm-hmm. He asks a question in that. Who gave us the right to judge these criminals? Now, if you just read the question as it is, then it's the most stupid question you could ask. People who had perpetrated the worst acts of atrocities, the worst atrocities since the gladiators of Rome, and even they were a picnic to what Hitler did. Right. We need a right to be judgmental. But it's not so simple, because from the question, from the answer that he gives, we learn that he poses the question to humanity without God, to an atheistic world, that God doesn't run this world. And now, let me explain what he asks. I ask you, you answer me. Did these criminals break German law?
No.
Break German sense of ethics? German sense of justice? Morality? No. So who are we to judge them? Who are we to judge them? Because we won the war and they lost the war. Might is right. Because you are stronger physically than them, it makes you more ethical than they are? It's not a simple question to answer. But to see the idea over here, I give this analogy to the idea. If there is no God, if there is no creator to the world, how did we all arrive on planet Earth? How did we arrive over here? But we all know Darwinism, we have evolution, macroevolution, microevolution, you name all the evolutions, everything that goes on, we all arrived. So whoever today is on planet Earth today is not here because he wanted to be. He is here what nature made him to. After a big bang and billions of years, we all arrived. So the elephant didn't choose to be an elephant, the giraffe didn't choose to be a giraffe, the fly didn't choose to be a fly, and the bacteria didn't choose to be a bacteria, and I didn't choose to be a human being. It's what nature made me. Professor Aaron Katzir, professor in Israel, he was murdered in the terrorist attack at Ben Gurion Airport over 30 years ago. He was the brother of the Israeli president, Ephraim Katzir, then. He asks this question. Who is better, man or a microbe? Who has a greater right to live, man or a microbe? I didn't choose to be a man. The microbe didn't choose to be a microbe. We're all questions of chance. So who is better, one than the other? No one is better than the other. He says science can't give answers to this, and science cannot answer a simple ethical question. So I'll give you an example to explain to you the idea. My idea is this. This little creature, I love this creature. It's called a mosquito. Now, nature gave him a very limited diet. That's why he's so slim. Yeah. It's called blood. Yours. For breakfast, dinner, and supper. He has a phenomenal digestive system. He has a proboscis, which penetrates the skin. And now he tries to suck up your blood for breakfast, but he has a problem. Your blood is so thick, it's like eating cholent on Shabbos with a straw. You try it.
You.
What? I can see you don't even like it with a spoon. That's your problem. Okay, so the phenomenal. So what does he do? He injects saliva, dilutes your blood. That saliva is the foreign body which causes it, can cause malaria too, but normally, and we don't see it today, almost, an infection or the itch and things like that. Okay. Now we walk around with bear sprays against mosquitoes. Psst. Okay. And this is a question I've got to ask, and I ask all your animal rights lobbyists. Why have become cats and dogs have become preferred creatures on planet Earth? Mm. What about flies? What about cockroaches? Or you call them roaches? Yeah. That's right. But he doesn't have a right to live. And just because he walks by and goes, lethal injection. Creatures have a right to live no more than less than a cat or a dog or myself. So why don't we put these people in prison for killing cockroaches? The answer is because the answer is a very simple answer. These creatures can harm me, and according to the United Nations Charter, we have a right of self-defense against people who can harm me, so I use bear sprays against mosquitoes. That's the answer. Nature gave me this answer. The word is called survival. That's the word. I want to survive. We have the right to survive. And this is the way we have the... don't be left to bother. Thank you very much.
Here.
That little cough for a second.
There you go.
Thank you. Take it easy. Thank you. Baruch atah Adonai Elohim Melech Haolam Shehakol Nidyei Bidyo. Okay. Sir Martin Gilbert asks a question. What will happen if one day in a godless world a person will stand up on the stage of history and he'll say there are mosquitoes who wear trousers? They are called Juden, Jews. The bloodsuckers of human society. They control the banks, they control the medical profession, they are making the money. We have 6,000% inflation. A massive amount of unemployment, and he actually did say these things. Mm-hmm. And the Jews are sitting in their offices with their Pierre Cardin ties and Yves Saint Laurent shirts. They're making the money. They're blood suckers. And I have a spray against these mosquitoes. It's called Zyklon B gas. Gentlemen, is he right or is he wrong? Ladies. In a godless world.
Wrong.
There will be a way. Right.
Yeah. No.
In a godless world, there will be a way. Right.
Prove to me he's wrong.
Because there is a difference between a human and an animal.
What's the difference?
The human can think, the animal cannot.
So because the human can think, that means...
Any human being.
What? No, there are humans who don't think very much, so I can
well, no,
explain
we know
it.
That, but...
Okay.
But doesn't give you...
Understand the point. Yeah. You know what his answer was? Sir Martin Gilbert writes, the only right we have to judge Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg is a concept which echoes through the atmosphere of history, whether you like it or not. And it's called the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. And in there it says, thou shalt not murder, which doesn't talk about bacteria, giraffes, elephants, and mosquitoes and flies and cockroaches. It talks about human beings. Without the Ten Commandments, Adolf Hitler is right from his point of view. Mm-hmm. This is what happens when the self is the central focal point in one's life, and then everything around it are the goals that he has in his life. I think that this, I have a quotation from Adolf Hitler alone. Adolf Hitler said he hates the Jews because they gave the world the Ten Commandments. That is the source of true anti-Semitism. We told the world there's somebody out there who tells us how to live our lives. So when a person says, is religion relevant, Torah, relevant to my life? The answer is no, because if you've already decided what your goals are and what your morality is and what your ethics are about, we can't do anything. Nothing can happen. Nothing will change you. In fact, our rabbis tell us this in a midrash, a very famous midrash, which says that when Hashem, before he came to offer the Torah to Am Yisrael, he offered the Torah to the nations of the world. And one of the nations, like Yishmael, and he said, would you like the Torah? What did they say? Ma ktuv ba, what's written in it? And Hashem said to them, one of the things is, lo tignov, you shall not steal. So he said, no, it's not for us, thank you very much. He went to Esav. He said, do you want the Torah? And he says, ma ktuv ba. The answer is, ma, lo tiltzach. That doesn't suit. It doesn't, no, you shall not kill, you shall not murder. Mm-hmm. It doesn't suit my lifestyle. You get the point? You want to make the Torah relevant. But I have a question. But one second. Even before the Torah were given, the Gentile nations were already commanded with what they call the seven Noahide laws. The Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. They already had to have those laws anyway. So why shouldn't they accept it as the Torah from a Torah point of view? Why shouldn't they accept it from a Torah point of view? They were ready. They're not allowed to steal or to murder from the seven Noahide laws. By the way, if you want to know anything more about this issue, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this before. I met a gentleman in this country, unfortunately passed away 4 or 5 months ago from a heart attack. Lived in the United States. His name was Professor Wendell Jones. A phenomenal person. I met him here in Los Angeles twice. Professor Wendell Jones, he wanted to convert to Judaism. Came from Dallas in Texas. He and his wife. And they came to a Beth Din in New York, and they said to him, why do you want to be Jewish? You're not Jewish, you don't have to be Jewish. She said, we want to live a life of truth. And we are disappointed, not disappointed, they don't believe in Christianity. So they said to him, I want you to keep the seven Noahide laws. Keep it because God has commanded you as a Gentile. You are fulfilling your mission and purpose in this world. No more, no less than our rabbis tell us. That any Gentile who keeps the seven Noahide laws, who mitzadike umot ha'olam, he is a righteous Gentile, the yeshlo chelek le'olam habo, he has his place in the world to come. We don't talk like Christians, who Christians say that Jews and Muslims all burn in hell because they don't believe in the Messiah. And Muslims say Christians and Jews all burn in hell because they didn't accept the Prophet. We say, the Jewish people say to the Gentiles, you have a purpose in this world. If you want to join our club, boy, you're taking your own big package. Anyway, Dr. Professor Wendell Jones set up a new religion in Texas and California today. There are thousands of them called Noahide Gentiles. He has a website. Go onto that website, Vendil Jones, V-E-N-D-Y-L. By the way, the film's on Indiana Jones about him. He is the model. He was the model. So they have the seven law of five laws. They had the seven law of five laws. Why didn't, well, did they accept the laws of the Ten Commandments, which are included in the seven law of five laws, which are belief in God, not committing against idol worship, not to kill, not to steal, not to commit adultery. Number five. Number six is not to eat flesh from a living animal, live flesh, and to set up a law and order system. These are the seven Noahide laws. Why didn't they accept it? I think the idea comes from a book. I saw a sefer called the Shiuri Dat of Yosef Leib Bloch, of the Rosh Hashiva of Tells in Lithuania. And he explains, prior to the giving of the Torah to the Jewish people, the seven Noahide laws which were given to the world were laws as commandments of a doctor to his patient. Now, when a doctor prescribes to a patient to take an antibiotic, if he doesn't take the antibiotic, he's committing suicide. But would you punish a person who goes to his doctor, he has a very sore throat, and the doctor prescribes an antibiotic? He comes back home, and his mother says to him, what are you taking? I said, I have to take this. Don't, what are you taking all this garbage over here with all the after effects? My Zayda used to tell us that if you've got a sore throat, drink hot milk with lots of honey in it. And he decides he'll try it. He drinks hot milk and a lot of honey in it. And it goes away. He goes back to the doctor after a few days, he checks his throat. Beautiful, you've been taking my antibiotic. I said, no. I took hot milk, my... Will the doctor punish him for not taking the antibiotic?
No.
Why not?
It's his choice.
What?
It's his choice.
It's not only the choice. The important thing is the cure. That's the important. The result is important. Before the giving of the Torah, the seven Noahide laws, if there was a reason not to have to keep that law, which was going to be a good reason, then you didn't have to keep it. In other words, you could choose whether to keep the law or not keep the law. We find that even our great father, founding father of the Jewish people, Jacob, he married two sisters. But this was before the giving of the Torah. So why didn't they accept it? They said, no, it's not for us. The reason is that before the giving of the Torah, you could vary, you could change. The day the Torah is given, there are no changes. Now it becomes what he calls Tzivui HaMelech, a command of the king. Now you cannot change. And if you don't take the antibiotic, you will be punished for not taking it. You found something else. First of all, it won't produce the cure from that moment on. And now you will be punished. Oh, no, no, no. If you're going to stop, God is going to start breathing down the back of my neck on everything I have to do. I have to do it this way, his way. Sorry, we don't want it. This is the difference between the giving of the Torah and not. What I want to say over here is this. Let's come back to Egypt. In Egypt, we went through slavery. What is slavery? What does it mean to be a slave? Now, the word Eved means to be a slave. But Eved doesn't have to mean the slave. A slave has a very negative connotation over here, of a person who's being abused physically, psychologically, like. The word Eved also means to be a servant. A servant. The butler in a British home, you know, walking around, sir, dinner is served, is also a servant, not a slave.
In Egypt, we were slaved. During slavery, what happened to that slavery? What is, how do you define a slave? A slave is a person who has no free will, he has no opinions, he is subservient to his master 100%. That is a slave. And you know why we needed that? So that when we came out of Egypt, we had become emptied from ourselves. We have now become empty. We have no opinions, no ideas. We were slaves. We are now free of the physical slavery of Egypt. We went out from avdut, from slavery, to chirut, to freedom. The freedom was a physical freedom, certainly. But we went through the most important aspect of our lives. It was the best training program for us to know you have no opinions. The self is now shattered. You have no self. I know it sounds very negative, don't worry. It's very sad. We'll explain ourselves. There is no self anymore. Now that there is no self, now you're going to be able to stand at Sinai and say, Naaseh V'Nishma. That's why we have to go through that program. What we call a negation of the self. When that self is negated, now we can stand at Sinai and say Naaseh V'Nishma. We are accepting what he tells us. We have no opinions, we have no values, we have nothing. For this reason, Abraham was told, you will have to go through Egypt, because if you don't go through there, you're going to argue every value system of God. If you were going to stand there and say, God, I don't agree with you. Yeah, like as we said. Like this 14-year-old boy with the teacher. We would argue. We had become emptied of ourselves. Emptied of ourselves. We have no goals. We have nothing at all. And now what you say, emet, we accept. That's how you say Naaseh V'Nishma. Now this sounds very, very negative. It means there is no self, there is no free will. The difference is in one concept, which makes Judaism what it is. And here is the important point. At the beginning we said, the self has goals in his life. Family, car, career, money, these are my goals. And also, my values are all part of filling in that goal of my life. Judaism is talking to us and saying, ladies and gentlemen, nothing in this world is a goal in your life. Nothing. Everything is now an instrument of a higher goal. It is not an end in itself as a goal. It is a means to a higher end. Does Judaism negate you having a car, having a family? In fact, there's a commandment to go and have a family. But here's the difference. The difference is, are we making it goals out of our lives? Or are we making it into means to a higher goal? At Sinai, Hashem tells us how to live our lives morally and ethically. He tells us what is right and what is wrong. We do have free will to choose between right and wrong. Ethical and non-ethical, moral and immoral. Certainly we have it. And everything that you have now, use that free will as an instrument for a higher goal. You can have a car, use it as an instrument for holiness. You have a home, use it as an instrument for holiness. All these concepts are now no longer goals in our lives, but means to a higher goal. Our rabbis tell us this in very simple words. Ha'olam hazeh domen prozdor le'olam haba. This world is a corridor to olam haba. Hatken atzmacha be'prozdor. Prepare yourself in the corridor Kedei dikanes letrakrin, in order to enter the hall. The Olam Haba is the hall. So what is it saying? A corridor which leads nowhere isn't a corridor. Those who believe that this world is an end in itself, is an end in itself, are the most pitiful creatures on planet Earth. These are not my words. These are the words of Dr. Viktor Frankl. Dr. Viktor Frankl, though I can't understand, the words he said were so true, so MS. Yet he himself remained all his life a very, very assimilated Jew. Until he died some 11 years ago. A very assimilated Jew. But I'm saying a person who was spent 4 years in Auschwitz, you never are judgmental of anybody what they believe. But he says that this is the world that we live in. He says our Western culture suffers today from a major neurotic syndrome. And you know what it's called? Meaninglessness. Going nowhere. Because we've tried to make our world into a goal in itself and it just doesn't work. Because we know it's not true. Torah tells us, use your free will now. Use that free will. Use what you have. Enjoy it. You can have the latest model Buick. You can have, but use it as now, no longer as a goal. A car made to inspire. It's a goal in my life. But to use it as an instrument of holiness. Elevate it. At the beginning of our talk, the self was the goal. Now we're saying the self is now a means to a higher goal. For that reason, we had to go to Egypt to clean us ourselves out from any philosophical ideas we have. We were slaved. When we stood at Sinai, we were now capable of saying, Na'aseh v'nishma. What's the beauty of those words that we said at Sinai? What's the difference? What is the difference between nishma v'naase, we will listen and we will do, and naase v'nishma, we will do and we will listen? Now, normally what we think, we say this way. We say nishma v'naase is what we've been talking about. Let me understand what you are commanding me to do. If it suits my lifestyle, I will do it. Na'aseh v'nishma is, I will do it, and I will study, find out what I'm doing. I do it objectively, not subjectively. But it's even more than that. Nishma v'na'aseh means that when Hashem gives us the Torah, I want to understand and I will do. In other words, I am. It's just a little way of saying the idea. I want God to relegate his mind to the human level. Relegate his mind, nishma, v'naase. Relegate your mind to us, and we will do it. Na'aseh v'nishma is saying to us, no, I want to elevate my mind, upwards, not bring his word downwards. This is the whole concept. For that reason, we needed that Pesach. We needed the Pesach, the Yetzias Mitzrayim, we needed to pass through Egypt. Clean ourselves out so that we can say now, I have no ideas, I have no values, I have no ethics, I have no morality. Hashem, what you want from us, this is Emes. And I want to tell you this. So in other words, we were slaves. We went from avdut, from slavery, lechirut, correct? To redemption, freedom. And the day we came out of freedom, we went straight into avdut again. Ta'avdun et elokim al ha'har hazeh. Serve Hashem on this mountain. Ta'avdun is elevated. So we're back to square one. No, it's a different type of avdut. Now it is, we're not becoming slaves of Hashem, now we're becoming servants. We are becoming a servant of Hashem. Certainly, again, with free will. If we have no free will, then we're robots. A slave is a robot. A physical slave in Egypt is a robot. But now we are no longer slaves. We are tavdun etz Elokim al harazeh. We are now elevating ourselves to a new level of servitude. Now we're serving Hashem. This is what Judaism is all about. The whole idea of the historical events that took place, we had to be pushed down to nothing in order to find out, to clean ourselves up and now be elevated to the higher level. And without that, we wouldn't have it. We would be fighting. We would be arguing. And I'll just add a little, one or two ideas that I spoke about yesterday. It closes the picture too. I spoke yesterday, I asked the question, why? What would happen if a child will ask us the whole idea of why we went down to Egypt, right? No, we came out of Egypt, the Hagon of Pesach, we talk about Egypt, the miracles, everything Hashem did, you know, Lahodos, Lahalel, Lashaber, to thank Hashem for the miracles and everything that happened. But then I asked the question, what would have happened if a child will ask at the table, say, Daddy, you speak about the Exodus, and invite to the Exodus, and more of the Exodus. Correct. But why did we have to go down to come out? So with tonight's talk, let's put it together. We went down also for another reason. As I say, I wanted to put both these ideas together in this talk, is to try and make it clarify. I want to ask you a question, a very simple question. What would have happened if we were never in Egypt? If Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob lived in Israel, we had children, many children, there are now a million Jews in the land of Israel, and one day Moshe Rabbeinu comes along and he says, ladies and gentlemen, pick up your pekalach, we're going on a journey. We're going on a journey into going to Sinai, and God is going to give us the Torah. What would we have said to Moses?
Nobody would follow.
Have a nice trip.
We're happy here.
Why?
What?
Why?
What? Yeah. There's a beautiful world out there. There's a beautiful world out there. There's a beautiful world out there.
But it's beautiful here. But it's beautiful here.
The answer is, for that reason, we went down to Egypt to see humanity, meet humanity with subjective values. When you see a world with subjective values, then you know what happens? You can look on the outside to be ethical and moral. But when you take that mask off, there's a monster of a human being underneath it. I've said this to every audience I can, we forget this. Don't forget, it's just something we don't think about. I just want you to know this. Have a look at the whole of the history of the Jewish people. The first exile, Egypt, before the giving of the Torah. The first exile after the Torah was Babylon, destruction of the first temple. The next exile was Greece. The next exile is Rome, which we are still in. Edom, Amalek, Esav. And we've suffered under the Spanish Inquisition. We suffered under Germany. The Masei Atzlav, the Crusaders. Right. What is the common denominator of all the names I've just now mentioned? Egypt, Babylon, Greece, Rome, Spain, Crusaders, Germany. What's the common denominator? Did God ever send us into Galut, into the jungles of the Amazons, the jungles of the Congo, the jungles of Malaya? No. You know why? Because from primitive people, you don't expect more than primitive behavior. Every exile was an exile into what was that period of history, the pride of humanity, with their values, their ethics, their aesthetics. They're wonderful. You always think the grass is greener on the other side of the fence, don't you? Go and meet them. And you're going to find that when people live with subjective ethics, subjective values, subjective morality, When that mask comes off, you're going to reveal a monster of a human being underneath the mask. This is the world we live in. And we have to learn, and we still haven't learned that lesson. Till this very day. The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. Mm-hmm. I told them last night a story of a letter in the Daily Telegraph going back many years ago. Yes, the elder statesman here in this room will certainly remember that person's name. I don't know if there was a very famous scandal in the United Kingdom called the Profumo Affair. John Profumo. John Profumo was the Minister of Defence, Minister of War, they called them then, of the British and the British government. That's going to go back nearly 50 years ago. And he was found to be a very, very corrupt person. He was involved in high-class prostitution and things like that. He was something ugly. Very famous name, Christine Keeler. Yeah? Those of you remember. Anyway, a person who was corrupt to the core, an animal with a capital A. Because the situation that he was the Minister of War, he was now a defence risk. He could be blackmailed to give over information, so he was asked to resign, to quit. And he did. End of story. That's the end of the story. I have in my archives a letter written by another person, a simple non-Jew, writes a letter to the editor of the Daily Telegraph, the London Daily Telegraph. And he writes in this letter, very simple, he said, "Dear sir, I would like to ask myself a question. If Mr. Profumo would have invited me for lunch to his house, and while eating lunch, instead of putting the fork in my mouth, I put the knife in my mouth, or had I eaten not with my mouth closed, but with my mouth open, what would Mr. Profumo have said to me? Were you born in a zoo? You've got no manners? Are you an animal? I have nothing further to add. ... Yours sincerely." This is something where we're learning about relativistic values. You can be the most corrupt piece of garbage. Corrupt piece of garbage, but never eat with your mouth open. It's not manners. This is what happens when we're living in a relativistic world of our own. Comes along HaKadosh Baruch Hu and gives us Torah. And in this Torah he's going to tell you there are no relativistic values. I tell you what is right and what is wrong. Objective, absolute truth that we cannot argue. So I have to stand up for an old man with all my arguments, and Hitler is a murderer because of the Torah arguments, and everything else we have to see. This is, now we are Avadim. Now we're serving Hashem. But we are serving Hashem not as slaves or even as servants. We are free. Free? Where I am, what do? I negate myself and my own personal ideas, which will argue with God's ideas. I have no ideas. What he says is emet. This emet is my life. And that's why people who are keeping Torah mitzvahs in the best of our ability, well, of course we're all sinners and no angels, right, feel at least I know I'm doing the right thing. I'm doing the right thing in the right place. Pesach is a time of freedom, physical freedom, but we are now entering a world of another freedom which comes after that, of servitude. That servitude of being a servant of Hashem. This is what I wanted to share with you in our lives. The beauty of what it means when we talk to our children and explain to them at the Leila Seder. We are sitting at this Leila Seder. Why did Hashem throw us into this Egypt, this great Egypt, to teach us what it means to be an Eved Hashem, to be a slave, to be a servant to Hashem? That is what I wanted to talk to you about. That's it. Our lives are to literally to fulfill our lives to become a godly nation. To become a godly nation. And when we're a godly nation, I think here lies the survival of the Jewish people. Because we are the only nation on earth who represents the will of God in this world. That's what he wants. And here lies that chemistry of our survival. Rabbi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Any questions? Good.
Yes.
So why were people punished before the Torah was given? Like, why was the world destroyed? Why are people punished before the Torah was given? I read in the book because our conscience is considered a warning, and like you can't be punished if you don't have a warning, and our conscience is considered a warning. But how can that be if you can argue morals?
Again, I'm asking again.
Before the Torah was given.
But the flood, why was the flood, why did the flood occur if they weren't told by God that this is wrong?
First of all, it's a good question. It's a good question. We have to know one thing. Even though there are, even before the seven Noahide laws were given, yeah, our rabbis tell us these words, Elokim bara et Adam yashar. God created man upright. Not that he stands upright. There's a certain nature, a human nature in a person. That's why man, because man is not an evolved creature. We are not just intelligent mosquitoes. You understand? He created man yashar. Within that yashar, there is a certain level of decency which is expected of any human being. Cain killed Hevel. Did anybody tell him murder was wrong? No. So why did he feel bad about it? You know why? Because it's human nature too. That's even a lower level, a more natural level in the human being. When the human being becomes so self-corrupt that his own nature becomes destroyed, that is, we are putting a bullet into our own heads. That is the flood. The flood brings about. Then you go to the next stage of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, of the seven Noahide laws. The seven Noahide laws, which is already a higher level. Now there are limits, there are everything, but it's now an objective seven Noahide laws. But as I explained before, it's still only on a level where man can decide whether to take the medicine or not, if it's worthwhile for whatever reason. The third level is the absolute level, and that is Maimed Har Sinai. That's why man is responsible from the moment he stands up on planet Earth. If he has a mind to be able to.
Thank you.
Any questions? Please. Ask and it shall be given. Matthew chapter 4.
I will say something. My name is Kazik. We're doing all this and we need your support.
Say that.
It's to bring more rabbis in Israel or to do these things. And if you can put some money there, donation to continue this program, it's good for the respect so we can be part of the program.
It's such a relevant lecture, you know, this idea, this issue, you know, but I was surprised to be asked to make an error. They also think that God, I'm surprised to be asked. They also think that God speaks to them. They also know that they're doing it because
Rambam, what does Rambam say? That Ishmael is a monotheistic religion.
Right. So maybe they assume they should
thank you so what? Much for
what? Coming. I'm just surprised nobody asked that.
No, what? What's the answer simple? The beginnings are long. The beginnings are long. There's no. Nothing can be
That's right.
The whole thing
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The whole program shatters on the spot.
I'm convinced.
Why do you need to say that?